Hello, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency, devoted to promoting musicians and authors worldwide. Call us today at 941-877-1552 to start your free publicity evaluation. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Please welcome the host of Interviewing the Legends, music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello, once again, everyone. I'm your host, Ray Shasho, and welcome to yet another edition of Interviewing the Legends with Ray Shasho on BBS Radio, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Bebop Deluxe was a 70s British rock group led by legendary guitarist Bill Nelson, who veered between glam rock, pop, and heavy metal with lots of demonstration of Nelson's guitar proudness. Bill Nelson wrote all of the band's material, signed to EMI, the band released 5 studio albums, and scored a top 10 UK hit with the single Ships in the Night. In 1979, Bill disbanded Bebop Deluxe and launched Red Noise, whose Sound on Sound album is often cited as an inspiration by many younger bands. Bill then formed his own independent record label, Cocteau Records, and throughout the 80s and 90s, he released many solo albums, as well as collaborating with other musicians such as Yellow Magic Orchestra, David Sylvian, Harold Budd, The Associates, Cabaret Voltaire, Sandy and the Sunsets, and Channel Light Vessel. As a producer, he has worked on albums for Roger Eno, The Skids, Gary Numan, you remember him from Cars, The Units, The Rhythm Sisters, Nash, The Slash, and many others. Bill has composed and recorded music for film, television, and theatrical productions. Since 2000, he has released many solo albums on his own label. Starrick Records is proud to announce the release of a new remastered 4-disc deluxe expanded box set limited edition comprising of 3 CDs and a DVD of Futurama, the legendary 1975 album by Bebop Deluxe. The album gained much praise thanks to Bill Nelson's composition skills and his highly innovative guitar play, featuring such wonderful material as Made in Heaven, Sister Seagull, Music in Dreamland, Soundtrack, Between the Worlds, Jean Cocteau, and Swan Song. The album would see Bebop Deluxe heralded as one of the most accomplished acts of 1975. Another highlight of this limited edition box set is the lavishly illustrated 68-page book with many previously unseen photographs and an essay of recollections by Bill Nelson. Additionally, the set includes a facsimile record store poster from Futurama, replica track sheets, and postcards. The special deluxe limited edition box set of Futurama is a fitting tribute to a fine band, the creative vision of Bill Nelson, and a wonderful album. You can order Bebop's Deluxe, and it should be available now at Amazon.com. Please welcome English singer, guitarist, songwriter, producer, painter, video artist, writer, experimental musician, and founder of the legendary rock group Bebop Deluxe, Bill Nelson. Hello, Bill.
Hi, man.
You've done a lot, man. You know, I saw the list of the albums that you've recorded and produced. It's, I can't believe it.
Well, yeah, sometimes I don't believe it.
Wow.
A lot of years, mind you.
It's amazing. It really is. Anybody, they should just go into Wikipedia and punch in your name and see how many albums you've got out there. It's 3 lifetimes of music. It really is.
Yeah, I guess so.
So what do you think about the new reissue?
good because basically what happened was that the material was originally with EMI Records, and EMI got to the point where they basically, you know, they don't really exist anymore.
Right.
And the material was passed on to Warner Brothers. And Warner Brothers didn't do a very good job of re-releasing things. It was rather shoddy. And then Warner Brothers were asked by the Monopolies people, Monopolies Commission, to divest themselves of some material because they'd bought up lots and lots of recordings from different record companies and had a bit of a monopoly on it all. So they had to divest themselves of some of the material, and amongst other things that came up for sale, the Bebop Deluxe recordings came up for sale. And Cherry Red Records and the Esoteric there, Cherry Red has a label called Esoteric, who I've been working with on some things in the past, decided to buy the Bebop Deluxe recordings and do a proper re-release job on them. And that's what happened, and they've started into that program of re-releases. They've already done the Sunburst Finish album, and the next one is this Future Armor. And they're doing luxury box sets with all the goodies in, and with remixes and surround sound mixes, so they're really doing the material justice. It's not like the cheap and cheerful thing that the Warner Brothers label put out.
That's incredible, and what's so important to you, I just had, I'm losing it right now. Annie Powell, I'm sorry. Annie Powell from Wishbone Ash, and they did a similar thing. You know, they did the box set from Complete History from Wishbone Ash. And the big thing about this thing is it's all documented for you and the band, and nothing can happen now. You know, like tapes can't be destroyed, you know, lost or anything like that. Now you've got your whole repertoire, you know, in order, which is incredible.
You know, now it's all on digital media,
right?
Which is a lot easier to maintain than old tapes, you know. So yeah, hopefully it'll be around a while. You know, I think after all these years, the material, despite it being from the 70s, it's over 40 years ago.
Right.
It still stands up. It still has a freshness about it that seems to work for today's audience. And of course, there are a lot of people out there who weren't born when you know, 40 years ago, when the records first came out. And it's there for them to discover and hopefully enjoy.
Exactly. And my job is to put it out there and promote it on the internet so it'll stay there forever and ever.
Okay.
You also have, you did a 70th birthday event, right? It was at the live streaming thing that you did?
Yeah. That was in December of last year.
Of last year, right.
We did a concert, an event, and an album launch at a very nice venue called the Clockworkers Hall, which is in Leeds, which is a city in Yorkshire. And we live streamed it for the first time. It was quite successful, I think.
I love the idea of streaming live like that. That's you know, the music coming live to your home, you know, that's very high tech. Very high tech.
Yeah, but we did it actually live, and then we kept it.
Right.
I think it's the end of December, you could go back and watch it again. So it was archived until the end of December. We've got now the original video and, you know, sound recordings from that concert. So we may actually decide to put that together as a DVD to release at some point in the future.
That'll be great. You got a lot of good music that's out for the public now, and we appreciate that.
Yeah.
You really do.
Exactly, yeah.
I tell you, man, you're a great guitar player. You know, I've been a big fan. I know Billy James has been a big fan of yours. He was very excited about this. You also, now forthcoming releases, are you in the studio making some more music on top of all this?
Yeah, well, I never stop. I mean, literally, it's what I do. I don't tour much these days. Well, I don't tour at all because I've reached a certain age and I've got health issues with diabetes.
Right.
And with my eyesight failing as a result of diabetes. So I only do the occasional concert that I record every single day. And I have about, maybe 12 albums lined up at the moment.
Oh, wow.
Come out over the next couple of years. So, that side of my musical life never stops. In fact, it's got more and more busy and complex as time's gone on.
That's incredible. You've recorded more than I've ever seen anybody do, as a matter of fact. your studio must be incredible. I heard you were doing some reworking of the new studio or something like that.
Yes, yeah. I'm about to move over. I've been using a hardware-based system for the last 19 years, which is kind of a hybrid hardware and software system. But I'm about to change over to a completely computer software, digital, way of doing things. It's something I've resisted for a long time. I like the hands-on thing of having a full mixing desk and being able to push faders. But it's now got to the end of its life, this system, and it's got various faults. So I'm about to move over to a software system. So I have a big learning curve to get my head around that. But hopefully it will, in time I'll get to grips with it, and hopefully it will improve things. But my studio's very small. It's just a spare bedroom, but it's crammed full of equipment and toys and things. There's a picture. There are pictures of it somewhere on my website. If you care to have a look, you'll see how cramped it actually is and it's full of stuff.
You did a kind of a documentary of your third album. I think it's on YouTube. Sunburst Finish. And it was you and John Leckie.
John Leckie.
Now, was that your studio? Because there was a pic there. You guys were sitting somewhere.
Yeah, that was the two of us. We managed to cram in here. Fixing this. Yeah.
I saw a lot of cool knickknacks in there. You collect a lot of little items around there. I do the same thing.
Yeah, a lot of sci-fi toys from the 50s and the 60s and all kinds of kids stuff, pop culture things. I kind of surround myself with them in the studio to give a bit of inspiration for certain things, but sometimes I look at it and I think, I've got to get rid of it. I find it hard to part with it.
I know. I do the same thing. I collect all kinds of stuff, and I just like looking at it around me,
Yeah. I do the same.
Well, I love John Leckie. He's incredible, and you guys were his first, I guess, his first job as a producer, right? With Bebop Deluxe.
John was an engineer.
Yeah,
a staff engineer at Abbey Road Studios, and when it came to Bebop's third album, I went to EMI and asked them if I could actually produce it because I felt I was ready to sort of move away from having the other producers come in and try and take the reins myself.
Right.
And EMI said, well, you really haven't had any experience of that, but here's an idea. We've got a staff engineer at Abbey Road called John Leckie. He's about ready to make the move from engineer to producer. What if we put the two of you together and you co-produce the album? And so John and I had a lunch together and had a chat and decided we could we could work together, and we went in and did the Sunburst Finish album, and that was John's first co-production and my first co-production, and then we went on from there, and then John later went on to produce bands such as XTC, Simple Minds, Stone Roses, lots of people.
Yeah, he's a cool guy too. He looks like a great gentleman.
He is. And you know, we've known each other since Sunburst Finish and slightly before that. And whenever I get to see John again, I mean, he lives quite a long way from me, so right. We don't meet up so often. But whenever we do meet up, it's one of those friendships where it's as if we've never, you know, been apart. It's instantly back there where it was, you know, when we started, and the friendship's really special to me.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad. I'm sure you guys will collaborate again. No doubt
about
it.
Yeah.
And the cool thing about, you know, if you wanted to bring in some, you know, collaborations with other musicians, they don't have to be there. They can just send, you know, do it all over, you know, an MP3 or something, I guess, nowadays.
You can phone it in.
Just phone it in?
Yeah, just phone it in, you know.
It's incredible. A lot of people are doing that nowadays.
Yeah. I'm not sure whether, you know, I like that so much. It's nicer to get people in the room with you, but you know, when budgets are small, that's one way to do it.
Exactly. And you know, with a small budget, you can create a fantastic album, you know.
Yeah.
Well, one thing about John Leckie too, one of my favorite bands has always been the band that arose from XTC, which was the Dukes of Stratosphere. I mean, I was a big fan of the Dukes of Stratosphere's albums.
Yeah.
You know, I thought
it was kind of like a side project.
Exactly.
You know? And it was sort of a tongue-in-cheek psychedelic album, but Andy Partridge is very much into that psychedelic 60s period, you know, as am I. And so, that sprung out of the XTC thing, and they chose to call it, called the band the Dukes of.
You know what I heard? Todd Rundgren produced a lot of XTC stuff too, and he I think he did some work with them with Dukes of Stratosphere. But he said the Dukes of Stratosphere came about because I think it was Andy that he didn't like to fly, and so instead of touring, they had a side band. They created the side band so they can keep working.
Album Todd did of XTC, so it's one album indeed.
Right.
And I know that from what I've heard from Andy, it wasn't the easiest collaboration, I think.
I heard that too.
A bit of friction. But, I mean, Todd's a fantastic musician.
Yeah.
And, I had his albums way back and admired his skills. We both have a guitar made by the Eastwood Company.
Huh.
It's a very unusual guitar. It's called a Backlund Model 100, and I got this quite a while ago, and then I noticed on the Eastwood Guitar website there's Todd Rundgren's playing one as well. So one thing we have in common is that guitar. So.
The guitar you have, I didn't take notice of the name on that documentary. It looks very 50-ish, you know, very nostalgic and very colorful. What is that guitar that you have?
Well, that's another one designed by John Backlund, which is the guy that designed the one I've just been talking about with Todd Rundgren.
Right.
It's a different model. That's called the Rocker Box.
I love it.
John Backlund designs, he's a fabulous designer, designs guitars and all kinds of things. I got Eastwood, to have a look at John's designs, and they decided to get into a collaboration with him. So Eastwood builds his guitars and John designs them. And they're really cool guitars.
Oh, it's a great looking guitar. You know, you look at it and it just, you know, screams nostalgia. You know, like from the 50s or early 60s, you know. It's yeah. It's incredible.
Guitars are my weakness. You know, I've got 70 of them in the house and no room really. I just love guitars.
Yeah, yeah. I play a little guitar myself, but I don't have that many. I'm kind of a Fender man. You know, I like Tellys and Tellys and Strats, I guess. But
I've got a Stratocaster. I've got a Fiesta Red custom shop Stratocaster. I've got a couple of Gibsons and a lot of other stuff as well. Not unusual, kind of, you know, bizarre, weirdo guitars as well.
Of course, with my shoulder the way it is now, I can't play anything.
Yeah,
that's a shame. Well. Yeah. Life goes on. You know, the Sunburst album was Sunburst Finish was probably my favorite album, and I remember when that came out in the stores. The cover. Did you design the cover?
Well, the idea for the cover came from me.
It's really cool.
My idea was originally to have a silhouetted figure.
Right.
You know, wasn't necessarily a girl or a guy. It was just a figure in silhouette standing on a hilltop outside holding up vertically a blazing guitar. And the guitar was supposed to be like a beacon, as if it was calling spacecraft down or something.
Oh, cool.
To the Earth.
Yeah.
And it was going to be a starry sky and then the silhouetted figure on the hilltop holding a burning guitar aloft. And EMI took the idea and got a photographer called John Thornton in to do the cover. And John was well known for his nude photography.
Right.
And so he decided to turn my silhouetted figure into a nude girl, which was probably a more commercial idea in terms of attracting people's attention, but wasn't quite what I had in mind at the time, you know.
But, you know, commercially and marketing-wise, that was a great idea.
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah.
Because, you know, in the mid-70s, you know, in the record stores, that was one of those albums that really stood out, you know?
Yeah, I can see that, yeah.
you mentioned on that album you did a lot of your lead guitar work, kind of thinking about Jimi Hendrix, right?
Well, certainly on one track, there's a track called Crying to the Sky.
Right.
And I wrote the song and then thought that it could have a kind of a Hendrix-y feel to guitar solos in it. And so I used a Univibe, which is a certain kind of pedal that you can put a guitar through, which was what Hendrix used on a lot of things. And that really gave it a flavor of the Hendrix sound. The solos in that are a nod to Jimi Hendrix without really trying to copy or anything. It was just my notes and my playing, but with the feel and sound of what might have been a Hendrix kind of thing.
Yeah, I love your guitar playing. Some of your guitar playing early days reminds me a lot of my mind is gone today. I apologize. what is wrong with me? The guitar player from with Bowie.
Oh yeah, Mick Ronson.
Yeah, Mick Ronson.
Yeah. A few people have said that.
Really?
You know, I mean, I was obviously aware of Bowie at that time, but I've never consciously thought about that. You know, I mean, my roots in guitar playing come from the early 60s, late 50s, early 60s. So I kind of grew up on instrumental music from that time. Guitar instrumentals like The Ventures and The Shadows, Wayne Eddy, Chet Atkins, Les Paul.
Oh, yeah.
Those kind of people were my early influences or inspirations, you know. And whilst I'd listened to them, I never consciously thought about being, you know, influenced by Mick Ronson, although I admired his playing. But I think it was, you know, particularly the first album we did, before we got signed to EMI, we were just a local band playing small gigs around Yorkshire. And it was just a fun thing. We all had day jobs and there was no real hope of ever becoming professional musicians. And we kind of got onto that glam rock thing for a bit of fun, and it was sort of subversive. You know, we were playing in pubs and working in clubs locally, and we had the glam, you know, look and doing that sort of thing. And it was a way to creep people out, you know, in a sense. It was a subversive act. But then we got signed by EMI, which was, you know, came out of the blue. It came out as the blue, really, because I'd made an album prior to forming Big Objects, called Northern Dream, an album called Northern Dream.
Right.
And it was a solo album, and EMI heard that and wanted me to record that again for EMI with proper musicians. And by the time they discovered that album, I'd already formed Big Objects and wanted to do that instead. So that was what eventually happened. And the first album, actually, Jim, was really just pulling together all the stuff we'd been playing live for a year or two and putting that on the album. But I was already writing Futurama when we were recording that album. So the Bebop stuff, it always slightly lagged behind the recordings. We were always slightly a bit behind what I was writing for the next album.
Yeah, now you're mentioning Northern Dream. You had a sequel to that, is that right?
Yeah. I did last year.
Right.
I thought it would be nice to sort of revisit the concept in a way, but do it in a slightly more modern style. And I did an album called New Northern Dream.
Right.
And it was kind of revisiting that 70s feel, but with a twist. And there were a couple of tracks on the album that I'd redid from the old album, and the rest were all new songs. So it was mostly new songs, but with a couple of the original Northern Dream tracks reinterpreted in a new way. So yeah, that was fun doing that. It was nice to kind of look back and look forward at the same time, you know, to bring it into a new era.
Yeah, it's another excellent album, by the way. That was another excellent release as well.
Oh, right, yeah.
I like the first three Bebop Deluxe albums were all kind of named after guitars, right? Axe?
Yeah.
Yeah, Futurama, which
is... They were themed on guitars. I mean, the first album, Axe, Fiction, has that double meaning, you know. an axe is, as most people probably know, is how some musicians refer to their instrument, their axe. So, you know, I was seeing Axe Victim as being me being sort of a victim of guitars. You know, I was mad about guitars. And also, it had that edgy sort of film noir, Pulp Fiction kind of feel about it as well. And then Futurama had sort of a double meaning in that there were some guitars in the UK in the very early 60s called Futurama guitars. And they were a kind of a cheap alternative to a Fender Stratocaster.
Right.
It looks a bit like a Stratocaster, but they were made much more cheaper. They were made in Italy but sold in England, and they were called Futurama guitars. But the Futurama also had another connotation in that there was an American World Fair, I think in 1939 or something, and at this World Fair exhibition, General Motors had a ride which people could go on called the Fabulous Futurama Ride. So I liked that pop cultural reference to the World Fair and the guitar reference, so that fitted in. And then Sunburst Finish, when that came along, the third album, that is the actual finish of my
Yeah. Very, very clever. Very clever. I want to say congratulations, too, because in 2015, you were recognized with a Visionary Award at the Progressive Music Awards.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's when you get to a certain age, people feel sorry for you for giving you awards. So yeah, but I got a Prog Rock magazine giving me the Visionary Award. I also got an award for my birthplace town of Wakefield. I got a star, Wakefield star, which is in the pavement.
Oh, really?
In Wakefield, it's a bit like the Hollywood, you know, stars.
Yeah.
But it's for different achievements in the arts. So I've got a star set in the pavement in Wakefield alongside people like Henry Moore, the sculptor, and Barbara Hepworth, who's also a sculptor, and playwrights, David Story, the playwright, and so on. So that was nice. And then last year, I was given an honorary degree, so I'm a doctor of art.
Congratulations. Yeah.
Which is hilarious, but there you go.
Well, you definitely deserve that one.
Well, I keep saying to people, I'm a doctor now. I can check your shoulders out or your elbows.
Thank you. Thank you. Just having that in your name is an honor. It really is.
Yeah. I was really chuffed. I was really pleased with it. Yeah.
Yeah. You're a doctor of music. Well, one, I do like YouTube because it's amazing. I miss the old days of going to the record store, of course, and playing your record on the turntable and having that, you know, great setup with all the speakers around and everything. I do miss those days. But as you get older, just to go on YouTube and you know, just find anything, you know, you want and play it, it is pretty incredible. But everyone needs to go. You got a lot of good music on YouTube as well, live stuff. And what I liked was the Bebox Deluxe Forbidden Lovers and Down on Terminal Street from BBC from 76. That's just, you know, two great songs if anybody wants to relive Bebop Deluxe live, you know. It's just and see what they're all about.
I mean, the thing is with the internet and music is it is absolutely, you know, it's just massive. There's so much stuff on there.
It is.
And finding the good stuff is the hard thing. You know, you've got to know where to look or what you've got to know what band you're looking for. If you're just trawling, it's just impossible to, you know, you could spend all your life in just trying to find stuff.
But the good thing is for the young musicians coming up to look at the greats, you know, and kind of copy them and, you know, take bits and pieces from what they're doing and add it to their music. You know, it's easy for them, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, the one thing is that it has kind of made a level playing field where anybody can, you know, and the same with the recording equipment, is that, you know, the computers have enabled people to record at home so easily. And now, you know, anybody that wants to put a recording together, do a little video and stick it up on YouTube. And, you know, sometimes it's great, sometimes it's not so great, but, it is a level playing field.
Well, I'm like you, I put all my interviews are on YouTube. And of course, you know, we're on iHeartRadio and we're on iTunes. We're all over the place. So, you know, when I do an interview, everybody gets to hear it for free, you know.
That's great. Yeah.
So that they can learn. It's, you know, it's history. It really is. It's all about history, you know. What started your fascination with Jean-Marie Cocteau?
Jean Cocteau?
Yeah.
That started way back in the mid-60s. I was at art college.
Okay.
Wakefield when I was a teenager, and I came across a book of his screenplays in the art college library, and the images that were reproduced I just instantly took a shine to, and then started investigating further and found out he was an artist in terms of painting and drawing. He was a filmmaker. He was a poet and a writer. He collaborated with musicians, a set designer. I just got really fascinated with the kind of thing he did. And so he was an inspiration.
See, this is what the kids need to do, you know. He was, I guess his time was like the 20s and 1930s and 40s. And
yeah, and into the 50s. I mean, he died, I can't remember whether it was the late 50s or early 60s, but, he had a long career. Some of his films are quite amazing. There's a film called, one of his first ones, it's called Blood of a Poet.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's very surreal, very strange. I mean, it's the kind of thing that you would imagine David Lynch would do today, you know.
Right.
He was doing this back in the 30s, so, yeah, incredible.
Yeah, he was described as one of the avant-garde's most successful and influential filmmakers.
Yeah, he was. And his most kind of commercial film was Beauty and the Beast.
Beauty and the Beast, yeah.
And that seems a classic, you know, because it was commercially successful as well as being very artistically successful.
I understand you have a fascination as well for flying, like Peter Pan.
When I was a kid, I used to superheroes.
Yeah.
And you know, they could fly. Peter Pan, before I got into superheroes when I was a little kid, I used to think that was great. I thought, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful to be able to just sort of leap up into the air and fly around the house?
And super
never happened.
Of course, Superman.
Yeah. I used to, back in the 50s, I used to buy all the golden age of Superman comics.
Yeah.
And all the other things, all the other superheroes. I had a fantastic collection. If I still had them now, they would be worth an absolute.
Oh, are you kidding me? It'd be worth a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you into any of the new stuff now, the Avengers and all that?
Not so. I occasionally watch those things when they come up on TV, and I can watch them and sit back and enjoy it. But they don't have to. There's a nice naivety about the early 50s
right.
superhero things that has a charm, you know. And I guess the new ones follow. They're updated and they follow the sort of computer CGI animation thing that makes you know, lots of whiz bangs and explosions everywhere. But I don't know. I don't enjoy them as much as the old. I like the old comics.
The old comics, yeah. Me too. I like the old comics as well. I was thinking about the Peter Pan thing. Steve Hackett from Genesis, you know, we talked in length about the Trick of the Tail album, and you know, one of my favorites because you know it's got songs like Ripples and Entangled. We talked about Entangled and the feel for that song. They were thinking about Mary Poppins, you know, and that whimsical type Disney stuff. That's what brought that out. So they're on the kind of the same wavelength as you are in a way.
Yeah, maybe so. But you know, I mean, when I was a kid, I remember going with my parents to see films like Fantasia, Singing in the Rain, and that kind of Hollywood musicals of that time, the Glenn Miller story.
Yep.
Those kind of warm, you know, just naive, technicolor films from that time, they did have it might seem strange that when you hear some of the kind of avant-garde things that I'm doing these days, you might wonder, well, how did that influence or become part of what I'm doing now? But it does have a place in there somehow. There's some of that feeling that gets into the music.
Right. That, you know, you have children that are into music as well, is that right?
Yeah. My son and daughter, well, I've got my oldest daughter lives in London. London, and she works casting sculptures for sculptors. They bring their work in a, you know, a maquette form, and she makes the cast. And my grandson is training to be an architect, and my youngest son is a great guitarist, and my youngest daughter is a singer and plays bass guitar and has a band with my son, so I'm really proud of them. They're all very creative.
It's in the DNA, I guess so.
I mean, my dad was a musician, he was a saxophone player.
Right.
And my mother, when she met my dad, was a tap dancer. In a tap dancing troupe. So, you know, that sort of thing, I guess it runs in the family.
It runs in the family, yeah. Do you have grandchildren?
Yeah, one grandchild. Yeah, he's studying at university to be an architect.
Wow. Now you're also an artist. What kind of things do you do, or is an artist?
Well, I mean, I design all my album covers.
Right.
You know? I haven't done any painting for years. I used to paint and do a little bit of sculpture.
Right.
But mostly it's drawing now. I do drawings when I have the time away from music. Sometimes I've done drawings to sell on the merchandise stalls at my gigs, so people can get an original drawing.
Mm-hmm. So you do, a lot of people do painting now, and you know, of course, they sell them, and you know, Annie Haslam does a lot of paintings. She's very good at it. David Gilmour's wife, ex-wife, is an excellent, excellent sculptor, and makes David Gilmour's Ginger Gilmour from Pink Floyd. She's a great sculptor, and she does.
Right.
Yeah, she does.
Well, a lot of musicians are, you know, being involved in different things. There's certainly a tradition that came out of the art colleges, art schools
exactly.
in England.
Exactly.
Pete Townsend, Eric Clapton, you know. There's a lot of guys that have made a name as musicians who came up through the English art school system. And I think in the 60s, that was a really fertile, creative place to be.
You know, that fascinates me a lot, the English art school system. And how many brilliant, you know, legendary, figures have come from that system. And, you know, you think of England, you know, it's not that big of a country, yet there's so many famous people that come out of the different, you know, cities and from that art school. It blows my mind. It really does.
Yeah. It was a great time for new thoughts. Well, the 60s generally, you know, obviously things started to change and music changed.
Right.
And all that was reflected, you know, in everything, and certainly was reflected in the art college days. You know, the pop art was emerging.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people like Andy Warhol were coming up, and Roy Lichtenstein, Peter Blake, you know, all these guys were doing interesting new things with art, so it was an exciting time.
Yeah, I tell you, man, England is brilliant. I mean, just so many, you know, important people coming from there, from all walks of life, you know, and it's like I said, it just blows my mind. Even in Yorkshire, there's so many people that came out of that from there, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's true. There's a lot. I mean, if you look at John McLaughlin, you know, from originally Marvishnu Orchestra and playing with Miles Davis. He's from Yorkshire.
Yeah.
Bill Cocker from Sheffield, you know.
Uh-huh.
There's the Human League, ABC. There's a lot of guys.
And not only musicians, but, you know, artists and celebrities.
Yeah, they talk me from here, yeah.
Yeah. I think I talked to Jim McCarty once. He was saying how close, Eric Clapton and Jimmy Page and Jeff Beck, how close they really actually lived to each other growing up.
That's right.
You know, it's incredible. It is amazing. Yeah. Are you listening to anybody today? New music? Anything that kind of sparks your? You know, I know you're in the studio doing nonstop music 24/7. But is there any new music you've heard that you like?
I haven't bought any new music for a while, but yeah. I tend to, if I ever get time to listen to
right.
music because of a make of my own, I tend to put on a lot of jazz stuff. I'm a big jazz fan, you know. Always have been since I was a teenager. And you know, jazz music, I guess, has influenced, you know, my guitar playing, even when I've played in rock stuff, you know, the phrasing of the solos often have a jazz feel to it. So yeah, I you know, I listen to lots of people like Wes Montgomery, Kenny Burrell, Django Reinhardt.
Yep.
I like Bruce Frizzell. That's one guy whose records I buy at the moment quite a lot. I've got a hell of a lot of Bruce Frizzell's records.
I love jazz too. I'm like you. I like the you know, the down home, dirty jazz like you find at the small clubs. Plus, you know, the fusion. You know, like the McLaughlin stuff and Billy Cobham.
Way back in the 70s, when I used to tour America with Bebop,
right?
And we were in New York. We had an agent, a guy working for the agency who used to sort of take the development. And his name was Bob Bonus. He's actually a well-known photographer now. He was on tour with the Beatles and the Stones when they were over there and took pictures of them. And there's been books published of his photographs. But at that time in the 70s, he was kind of looking after Bebop Deluxe when we were in that area of America. And when we were in New York, he used to take me to a couple of jazz clubs, one called Eddie Condon's and another called Jimmy Ryan's, which sadly no longer exists in New York. But these clubs were really cool, and we'd do a gig, and after the gig, the guys in the band would go off partying, and I'd go off with Bob to one of these jazz clubs, and we'd just sit and chill out and listen to guys playing jazz, and it was just the most sublime, relaxing experience,
yep.
You know, and years later, I went back to New York, and I took my now wife, and I said, come, we'll go find these jazz clubs, they're really nice, and we went down the street where they were, because they were almost next door to each other, originally, and they knocked them down, and there was just a car park there.
Oh.
It was really sad.
That is sad.
yeah.
There is a lot of good music out there. I'm listening to a lot of new prog music because there are a lot of new prog bands out there.
Yeah.
And there's a blog station, podcast station called Murrow, Murrow, that plays all new prog stuff, which is kind of cool. But yeah, but I'm like you. I mean, you know, there's nothing commercially out there that I would listen to. You know.
I mostly working every day on things.
Yeah.
But, you know, by the end of the day, when I switch off, I want to go downstairs and I watch TV for an hour or two and then go to sleep. You know, so I don't get a chance to listen to a lot of music. Mostly I listen to it in the car.
Yeah.
If I'm traveling anywhere, that's when I tend to listen to music.
You know, how do you get your juices going, you know, your creative juices working. What inspires you to, you know, to write new music, new songs?
Oh, I don't know, everything. Particularly when you get to a certain age, I mean, I'm 71 this year, so it's like, you start to take stock of where you've been and the journey you've been on and so on, and you look at different points along the way, and some of them can be, you know, inspirational. I write about all kinds of things. I write about memories from my childhood. I write about my, you know, interest in pop culture and so on, about romance and comes in over the poetic life, about landscape, and because then, you know, the songs, I don't always write songs that are vocal, so the instrumental kind of things have got a really wide open scope. You can go anywhere with the instrumentals. You can, you know, paint pictures about landscape, about interior landscapes, about inside yourself, feelings. You don't have to pin it down into words. It doesn't have to be
right. That
explicit. So, mm-hmm. So I find that, you know, a nice thing to do. Because when you've written as many songs as I've done over the years, sometimes the words are not the way always you want to go, because they are, you know, you can only say so much in words about certain things. But with instrumental stuff, it's like an infinite canvas. You can continue painting forever and ever. And instrumentals can express a lot of subtlety, a lot of things that are implied rather than stated.
From your mind to your fingertips to the guitar.
Yeah.
That's cool. I like that. Yeah, you're right. We have a limited vocabulary anyway. You know, we really do. And
yeah, but, you know, what do people think about? You know, it's, you know, millions and billions of love songs and breaking up songs. And
yeah, exactly.
Do that, but,
yeah.
You know, sometimes, I don't know. And other times I like to work with words in a totally abstract way, you know.
Right.
Putting things together that maybe don't, on the surface, seem to make sense, but they paint strange pictures.
Yeah.
So that's another way to, you know, to get out of the kind of cliches of lyrics is to work with, you know, use them to paint images rather than to tell stories.
It's so easy to, you know, to see a picture in a song, you know. And everybody has sometimes everybody has a different interpretation, and they relate it to their own lives or whatever, which is really cool. I love that.
Well, that's the amazing thing about music is that, you know, you can lay something down and you can have a very specific idea of what it means to you, but when it's out there and somebody else hears it, they apply it in a totally different way, and they get something else from it that perhaps you never intended, but it works perfectly for them in their own way. They project their own, you know, experience onto those words or the sounds or whatever, and that's a beautiful thing.
I still say music is the way to solve peace in the world.
I think so. I honestly think musicians and artists anyway, artists in general, whether you're doing music or theatre or writing books or whatever you're doing, making films, artists, I think, are the new priests. They're kind of the guys that can offer a kind of a medicine for the bad things that go on in the world.
Well, I tell you, I would have never existed through certain parts of my life if it wasn't for music. I would have never made it.
Yeah. I'm the same.
Listening to guys like you.
Well, thank you.
Well, what it is, you know, you have that sophistication, style in your music, you know. The brilliance. That's why I like prog rock so much. You know, you can, you know, it's so powerful, epic. You know, it's that kind of epic thing. You know, you think it to Beethoven's and Mozart's, and you put it into rock and classical rock and things like that. And you know, like, I mean, you follow those guys like Bowie and, you know, Genesis and Yes and you know, that kind of style in a way, but you know, you're such a great guitar player. It just stands out, you know, above all that as well.
Thank you.
What? Here's a question that you will be surprised at. This is one question I go totally off. I like to talk. I'm a big space nut, of course, and I do believe in aliens and things like that. And I always ask artists if they've if they do believe in extraterrestrials, and if, you know, have we been visited? Do you think there's life out there? What is your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I think it's very difficult for anybody to look out and see the vastness of the universe and the you know, infinite number of stars there are and the infinite number of planets that's probably going to heaven to say, I don't know how anybody can say, we're the only people.
Right.
They're the only life forms in the universe. There's got to be. There's got to be more life forms. Probably millions of other life forms.
Right.
Out there. But the distances are so vast, I don't know how easy it would be for them to come to us. It certainly isn't easy for us to go to them. But maybe some of them are so advanced that they've got the technology to get here. So I don't dismiss, you know, UFOs or anything like that. I think there's a great possibility that we have been visitors in the past and are perhaps still being visitors. I don't know. But it's a big subject, and but I certainly think there is life out there.
The universe is so mass, and it's still growing. You know, and they say it's still growing.
It's still expanding.
Yeah, it's still expanding. But you know, for us to get there, we need like a Star Trek Enterprise. we're moving.
Maybe one day, maybe a few hundred years from now, they'll crack the way to do that. They'll find some kind of drive that can transcend time and space. But at the moment, we're limited to, you know, to Mars, I think.
Yes.
As far as human beings are going to go. We're already sending probes out beyond the solar system.
Right.
So that's an amazing thing.
That's amazing, yeah. I guess that the next project is going to be in our lifetime. We're going back to the moon, and then they want to send a rocket. They want to establish a base on the moon, and then send the rocket to Mars from the moon. So that'll be the next step.
That would be great. I mean, the idea of we've got space stations, you know, going around the Earth.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, that was pure science fiction.
We
never thought that would actually happen. But that is happening, you know, with the space stations up there with people on. A base on the moon seems very possible.
Chris Squire, I had a conversation with him when he was on holiday in Hawaii, and he did a song that kind of reflects that, what he thinks. He thinks we are visited from by UFOs currently, but it's actually us from the future coming back.
Yeah.
That's his thinking.
I've heard that story as well, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know, you know. It's all speculation, but the human imagination is amazing, because things that we imagined 100 years ago and we thought they were purely imaginary things are happening now.
You know?
I mean, look at, you know, mobile phones, the internet.
Yeah.
This is all stuff that was the stuff of science fiction.
Yeah. I think so much great music comes out of England, too, because you guys have been around for a long time. I mean, just your history itself, you know, I tell people that. I says, you know, like prog rock, I mean, you guys invented that, man. That was in your DNA. Bill Hillier, here's your last question. And I ask this question to everybody and get some interesting answers. If you had like a Field of Dreams wish, like from the movie, to perform or collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be?
Oh, gosh. Well, obviously, you know, every guitarist, I think most every guitarist, is a great fan of Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
And I would have loved to... I don't know whether I would have dared have the nerve to play with him, but I would have loved to have sat down and chatted with him, you know, and just talk to the guy. That would be really special. But as far as actual collaborations, maybe nothing to do with music. I'd like to collaborate with David Lynch, the filmmaker.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I really like his work. And I've recently read his biography, which is fascinating. And I think I could really get to grips with doing some music for his movies.
It kind of sounds like you want to head that way towards like music scores and things like that, huh?
Yeah, no, I've done a few things for films in the past. Not a lot, but
right.
I've done, I did a film called Dream Demon.
Dream Demon.
Which was in the 80s.
Okay.
And I did the score for that. It was a kind of a surreal horror film. And then I've done some music for various drama and documentary stuff on television. And some music for advertising as well. But and I did a PBS special, American PBS documentary called American Stamps. It was about stamps that are picture stamps that were made in America.
Right.
So they had different themes. Some were musical stamps, some were scientific stamps, some were sports stamps, and so on. And they made a documentary about the artist that designed these postage stamps. And I did the music for the documentary film, and it was on PBS in the States.
Yeah, I'd like to see you do more of that, especially movie scores, you know?
Yeah.
A big one, you know? Something, I don't know, like a sci-fi movie, or that would be cool, or
yeah.
How about a James Bond theme?
Yeah. Well, you know, John Barry, who is famous for the James Bond theme, it's from where I live here.
That's right. I read about that. Yeah, John Barry.
Yeah.
That's pretty well. You know, you never know. You know, you just got. I guess you got to get into that circle. How do you get into that circle? I guess just people you know, basically, huh?
Yeah, it is a lot of people who tend to get the job doing that tend to stick in there.
Right.
It's a matter of being in London and hanging out with the right people, but I'm not that kind of guy, I guess. I kind of stay in my own little cocoon and get on with what I have to do. So maybe I don't network enough.
I've turned into you, Bill. I don't get out much. I should be out there networking. I used to cover a lot of live concerts, and you know, the last one I did was with Uriah Heep here in Orlando, and I should be doing more of that, but I don't, you know, because I do most of my interviews here and then in Florida, and then it's broadcasted from California, so I don't need to go anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah,
I'm just like you. I want to thank you, man, for being on the show today. You're a great musician, great guitarist, for all the great music you've given us with bebop, and all the new stuff coming out. I mean, you know, we can't thank you enough for all the great music you've given us.
Thank you very much.
You spoiled all of us.
Well, I'm just having fun and hoping somebody else has fun with it too.
And we're really excited about the Futurama. That's a great project. Everybody needs to. I think it's out now, right? On Amazon.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, it was recently released, and everyone can go on Amazon. And of course, your official website is www.billnelson.com.
That's right. Yeah, and if anybody wants to hear, you know, samples of the new music I'm doing, there are videos and samples of it all up on that website, yeah.
Thank you, Bill, for being on the show today, and God bless you, man. Keep up the great work.
Cheers, sir. Thank you very much.
We'll keep in touch again, okay?
Okay.
All right, Bill. Take care.
Cheers. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye now. order Bebop Deluxe Futurama. It's a 3D, 3CD, 1DVD set available now at Amazon.com. For more information about Bill Nelson, visit www.billnelson.com. Very special thanks to the great Billy James of Glass Onion PR for arranging this interview with Bill Nelson. And, of course, the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsome of BBS Radio for making the magic happen for each and every broadcast of Interviewing the Legends. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, please contact me at interviewingthelegends@gmail.com. And please subscribe to my YouTube channel, Interviewing the Legends with Ray Shasho, for the very latest interviews. Hey, it's real news, people. And don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of an Eclectic American Family and a Wacky Family Business, available now at Amazon.com. I promise you will live it. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Tune in to Interviewing the Legends every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time on BBS Radio, Station 1.